life depends on it. All right, so I'm really excited to introduce our speaker for the evening, Diana from Hanford with 26 years.
Hi, everybody. I'm Diana, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank Bill for asking me to speak in November. So you know how that messes with your head, don't you? So I'm going to ask my higher power to take over my words, because what I thought I was going to say, I don't think anything's going to come out like that at all. So if we could just have a minute, maybe my knees will stop shaking, and we can invite this God of anyone's understanding and mine to be here. I think I'm supposed to tell you in a general way what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now in 20 minutes, maybe 25. The best I can tell you, and this is all things I learned after I worked the steps, because what I knew before I worked the steps was nothing. What I learned before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous was about I, self, and me. It was the me show. Everything had to be done my way. And after working the steps, what I realized is I came by that naturally. I came from two parents who were both raised by alcoholic fathers. One was the town drunk and died in the gutter of Dayton, Ohio. He left his wife and seven kids when my mother was a freshman in high school and everyone had to quit what they were doing and go to work. And as I reflect back on what she had to go through with this man living in her home until she was 15 or 16 years old, I never had any sympathy for her or any compassion for her. Because when I got to know her, she was an angry, bitter, resentful woman. And I vowed I was never going to be like her. And they turned out to be just like her. My father came from an alcoholic who was supposed to be very successful, and I believe in his own right he was. But when I met him, all my memories of him is that he was just a mean son of a gun. All he did was grunt. And after I got sober, I found out that he was not a nice father. And my father became very arrogant, very self-righteous, a very, very intelligent man. And he never let us forget that he was a very intelligent man. I know without a shadow of a doubt that he loved me. I know without a shadow of a doubt my mother loved me. But there were conditions, and that was that you couldn't speak and you couldn't tell your truth. And when I was 21 years old and I had to argue with my mother about something, she slapped me across the face. And so that was another reaffirmation that I was not to tell the truth. And whatever you wanted me to do, I would do, and I would say, okay. My first drunk was when I was right after I graduated from high school. It was a hoot. I went out with a girlfriend and two of our male friends, and we were just friends, trust me. And I drank, and we played pool, and we laughed, and we talked, and on the way home, I got on the back of their convertible, and I laughed all the way home, and then I puked all night long. And I was living at home at the time, and my father called me up on the phone. He was at work on that Saturday morning. He says, "How you doing, honey?" And, oh, man. Oh, I said, "I am sick." And he said, "You feel like you're going to die, don't you?" And I said, "Yes." He said, "Good," and he hung up. My last drunk was not fun. My last drunk was not fun, but I had the same results. Only the next morning I woke up full of shame. I had a very normal, boring life, and I got married when I was 21 years old. I got pregnant right away, and when our daughter was 5 weeks old, my husband went to Vietnam, and he was gone for about a year. And I believe that up until about 2 months ago, I would have said, man, when he came home, he changed, and our life was never the same since. And it took just one more inventory for me to be able to tell you I changed, because in that year with a little girl, I had to go back home and live with those parents, that mother and that father that you couldn't talk to. who were angry at each other and who blamed and who yelled and who screamed at each other, and nothing was ever good enough. And I lived that year in just so much terror. Number one, that my husband was going to die. And number two, I believe that I thought I was going to have to stay in that house for the rest of my life, and I would have died too. A little story is that when he was in Vietnam, we didn't have computers and we didn't have cell phones. So the way we communicated was through a ham radio operator. And I'd get a call in on the home phone and ask if I was there. And I had a call coming from Mike from Vietnam, and would I accept the call? And it was the dumbest call I've ever made. You know, I love you, I miss you, over. You know, and that's the way we communicated. Why I ever wanted to come home, I don't know, because I was just really stupid at the time. Somewhere along the line, and I can't tell you where, and I don't know how many women can understand this, and maybe men too, that I had an idea of how you were supposed to be married. I had an idea of how this husband was supposed to be. Oh man, I'm embarrassed to tell you this right now. And I spent most of our marriage unhappy at him because he was not fulfilling my life. And you know, I always had a roof over my head. We had three daughters. We moved 9 times in 10 years. We continued to move. I was never grateful. I was never grateful for what I had. How embarrassing is that? To be able to stand here and tell you that this obsession of my mind was that there wasn't ever enough. We had three daughters when we moved to California. And when we moved to California, up until we moved to California, we were too broke to ever really drink much. I remember a neighbor, when we moved to a house in Chicago, had a welcoming party for us. And she served the most delicious punch. You're getting ahead of me here. Man, did I hurt the next morning. And my husband said, well, didn't you know you were drinking a velvet hammer? I said, what? Oh, man, it was. It just went just like that, you know. But when we moved to California, we had a little bit more money. And we lived in a house that was next to a tennis court. And we played a lot of tennis and we socialized a lot. And they sold wine and gallon jugs. I'm not quite sure that's when my alcoholism took over. I will tell you that I have drank since I was a child. My father was a beer distributor. I came from a Catholic family where we celebrated everything, a baptism, a confirmation, a wedding, everything. And there was always alcohol. We were big card players. And part of my step work was going back and remembering some of these times. And what I remember, especially about family reunions, is we would get together and everybody would look really good. And everybody was so happy to see each other. And by the end of the evening, they were calling each other's names. There was a fight that was getting ready to break out. I never knew it was alcohol. To my knowledge, there are only two of us in recovery. And I'm so grateful that I get to be one of them. So when we moved to California, my husband was taken away. He traveled more and more, and his social life became more and more. And my responsibility with the girls continued to be more and more. I had two USS swimmers, and if anyone knows what that schedule is like, is you have a 5:30 a.m. workout, and then there's another workout at 9. I did not know how to tell you. I couldn't do it. I thought if I got up a little bit earlier in the morning and worked a little bit harder and tried a little bit harder and would volunteer for the PTA and I would be that room mother and I would be that swim mother and I, oh my God, I do not know how I did it. And what I found out is that alcohol made me feel good. I remember a cousin came over to the house and they were in the backyard and my husband came in and he said, do you want a joint? I said, what? He said, do you want to smoke a joint? I said, no. As he left the house, what I said to myself is, I'm so dependent on alcohol, I know what a joint will do to me. Did I think I was an alcoholic? Absolutely not. Because here's my MO. I can tell you who you are. I can tell you what's wrong with you. I can tell you what's wrong with you, and I can tell you what you are. But I couldn't see it in myself. Because I was always trying to live up to the standard that I could never live up to. So I had to get up a little bit earlier and try a little bit harder. Somewhere along the line, and I can't tell you what the day was or the time was, is that alcohol became everything to me. I would drink in the morning. I would drink at one time. I worked about a half a mile from the house, and I'd come home and, you know, I have a couple glasses of wine and a little bit of lunch and go back to work. I would do my carpools in the morning, 5:30 workout, hungover. And then that late carpool at night, 9:30, I would call them a little nap before I picked them up. Now I know it was passing out. And that's how my life had become. This is an open meeting, isn't it? Do we have anyone here in Al-Anon? No one except for me? Okay. What I want to say is, in 1992, I couldn't take someone else's drinking and be okay with it. It was killing me. And I didn't know what to do. And I finally went to my doctor, and he recommended that I go to Al-Anon. And I did. And I was in Al-Anon about a year and a half. And what I know is this group, the groups I was in Al-Anon, what they did is they taught me how to love you. And they taught me how to have unconditional love. And they taught me how to love an alcoholic. And I will be forever in debt, because what I can tell you is I can live in this world now and like you and even love you, even though you don't mind me. And that's been my MO. You don't mind me? Okay, goodbye. You know, I have this kind of hand's length. So I was struggling in Al-Anon. I couldn't imagine why. I know why now. And someone suggested I go to an open AA meeting, and they say, if you want to see love and you want to see gratitude and you want to see balloons and happiness, go to this open AA meeting. It was a birthday speaker meeting, and I've never been to anything like that. We had people laughing and clapping and celebrating years and years of sobriety, and I just couldn't believe it. And it was fun. It really was. And then this man got up and he started talking, and his name was Charlie C. from Southern California. He looked like Mr. Peepers, and I can say that because he said that himself. And he had a story that I could not relate to at all. And but everyone was just laughing their ass off at him, and he was funny. And then what happened is he started talking about how he felt. He started talking about his potential. And it's like, when he started talking, I guarantee you, I thought the room had cleared and it was just him and I. Because what he said to me, what he said to me, was everything I could understand. And what I knew at that moment, alcohol was my issue. And because I was drinking, I had become a woman I didn't want to be. I was angry. I was bitter. I was not a good mother. I was not a good wife. I just wasn't. And I knew I wasn't, but I couldn't change it. Well, of course, I'd had a couple glasses, you know, whatever. And, you know, that just made everything better for that night. So I went home, and I decided to stop drinking. What I heard him say was about his alcohol use, not Alcoholics Anonymous. I was at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, but I did not hear Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went home, and that was in July of 1993. And by October 22nd, it was a Friday morning, I woke up. It was a beautiful day. Everything was going my way, and I woke up absolutely miserable, restless, irritable, and discontent. And by 7 o'clock that night, I was drunk. And by 8 o'clock, my husband came home. We picked a fight with each other. He went one way drunk. I went another way drunk. And the next morning, I woke up very sick at my stomach, very disgusted with myself. And I asked God what was wrong with me and if he could help me. And I knew without a shadow of a doubt I was an alcoholic woman and I needed to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I felt right at home in the beginning. because what I heard them tell me, I heard them tell me about the allergy to alcohol and the phenomenon of craving. And when I heard that, I knew that I belonged there. I knew that I wasn't bad. I knew that I wasn't wrong. I knew that I had a disease, and I believed that with every fiber in my body. But with my alcoholism and my arrogance, all I started hearing were the stories. And I didn't have that story. And I thought, oh my God, I don't belong. Now, I didn't stay after a meeting. I didn't pick up a 30-day chip. So proud of you all for picking up a chip. Wow, does that take courage? It really does. I didn't have it. My arrogance is so big. And so I started going to that meeting, and after a while, I thought, I don't belong. And a woman caught me after one of the meetings, and she asked me how I was. And I think I just kind of vomited words, you know, in her path. And she finally said something that I hope everyone here can hear me say. Look for the similarities, Diana, and not the differences. And, you know, Bill asked me to talk about my spiritual experiences and my spiritual awakenings in Alcoholics Anonymous. I wouldn't be standing here today if I didn't have a profound amount of those. Because my very next meeting was a third tradition meeting, and it says, the only requirement for membership is the desire to stop drinking. I earned my seat. I earned my seat because, by God, I had a desire to stop drinking. Because, see, I don't want to go back to that mean woman that I was. I wasn't loving, and I didn't feel kind. I was kind on the outside. I knew how to. We know. You know, we know how to do that. So I ended up getting a sponsor, not because I wanted to, but because I was dying. What happened is I stopped drinking, but I hadn't done anything to change me. I was going to meetings, but meetings didn't make me sober. Because meetings are wonderful, but that didn't change us. Didn't change me. I just got information. And I was, yeah, that's good information. Yeah, thank you. But I didn't change, and I got that sponsor. And, you know, she took me to that first step, and she said, we don't need to talk about you working the first step, because she said, I've been listening to you in meetings since you were in Al-Anon. Your life is unmanageable. You are powerless over everything, and your life is unmanageable. She must have taken me to the 12x12, because the first step, it says, who cares to admit complete defeat? Well, not me, you know. And I fought that for a long time, and I want to tell you something here. I worked the steps with her. I did everything she asked me to do. You know, she told me in the second step that I needed to find out a higher power, and I could have a designer God. I could have everything in a God that I wanted. And see, I had treated God, who was very important to me my whole life. I had treated that God like I treated my husband, like I treated my kids, like I treated everybody. You know, I pushed him away because he wasn't my Santa Claus God. He wasn't giving me what I wanted. He wasn't giving me what I thought I deserved. And then she told me that I had to make a description of what I wanted that God to look like, because someday I was going to need a God with skin on, and I did. And then we went to step three, and she pointed out to me in step three, it says right before the third step prayer, we talk about our little plans and our little designs. And that had been my whole life, my little plans, my little designs. And then we got down on our knees, and we said the third step prayer together. And I say that third step prayer a lot today. I was batshit crazy. I can't mince words. I just don't like to use those words at the podium, but I was. There's just no way to get around that. And she said, well, I'm leaving. In 2 weeks, I'm going away for 6 weeks. What? You know, I had finally learned how to trust her and to hold on to everything that she was saying. And I met with her every week, and she said, yeah, I'm going to school in New York for 6 weeks, and you can't call me. You can't contact me. Do you want to do your fourth step now? Yeah, I do. And I did everything I could do to get out of that fourth step until the night before we met. And I was crazy. And what happened, I asked God for help, and I wrote my fourth step in an hour and a half. And the reason why I'm proud of that is because it's all up here. It's all up here, and it's like that little gerbil in the cage. It just keeps on going round and around and around and around and gone around and around my head for a lot of years. So I give it to her in 2 weeks, and she left. She heard my fifth step, and you know, I cried. And she says, well, we might as well talk about the sixth step and character defects. And I thought I had written them quite well. Oh, one other important thing about the fourth step. Can't miss telling you this. I found out for the first time in my life writing that fourth step that I had a part in my own life. Whoa. Man, whoa. I did not know that. I thought everybody else was responsible for my life because I had made them responsible. You know what I mean? You do. I see hands nodding. In that sixth step, she told me, I listed my character defects, and I was quite proud of them. And she said, well, you forgot arrogance. I said, I am not arrogant. And she said these words that she has said to me many times, well, why don't you go home and pray about it and ask God to show you? Well, don't ever do that. Don't, because you get it in spades. And I, you know, ever since then, I know that I have a big ego and I have, I'm arrogant. And, you know, I learned how to, she had me also identify my character defects. They have names. They have, you know, I dress them up so I know what they are. And seventh step. Oh, I love that seventh step. Who doesn't love that seventh step? Here it is, God, what do you want to do with it? Bam, it's over and done with. You know, but we have to be willing to see that defect, how it's serving us. I was in a grief ministry for a while, and the priest who taught us how to do this support said to the patients there, the people there who had lost someone, we have to be able to name what it is so we can claim it, so we can tame it. And I got to use that with I still get to use that today with my sixth step and my character defects. And it works. It does. Seventh step is awesome. Eighth step, man, made a list. I had that list. And I think one of the most profound things of the eighth step is on page 86 to 88 of the big book, Upon Awakening. And it tells us in two pages how to do our day. Bam. Oh, close the door, you know, go on out. When facing a decision, we stop and we ask God, we pause. That pause is pretty special, isn't it? Isn't it? Boy, it has saved a lot of people here, haven't they? Yeah. You just pause when agitated, yeah. And I got to do nine, scared to death. My sponsor had me write a letter to every person I need to make amends to. And then she would proof it. And then she'd have me go rewrite it, and she would approve it. Because, see, I still had that part in me that wanted to say, well, if you hadn't done that, I wouldn't have done that. It's going away slowly. 11 is powerful. Step 11 is powerful. It has saved a lot of lives in my family, my doing step 11. It really has. It has saved my life because I know that there is a God. I know that all I do, if I get down on my knees, I don't even get on my knees. He didn't even require that if I stop and ask, help, help, he's there. You know, step 11, sought through prayer and meditation. Bam. And 12 is the best step of all. Having had a spiritual awakening, I've had many. And my first sponsor, I've had four sponsors. I've had a period of time when I wasn't sponsored. My life went to hell in a handbasket. I often would think, what if I'd had a sponsor during that time? I wonder if it had been different. Duh. You know. I trust these women. There's three rows of women here. I moved to Hanford almost 3 years ago, and I started going into meetings in Visalia about a year and a half ago. And the women in the first three rows have saved my life. I know that any one of them I could call. We can't isolate here, ladies and gentlemen. We can't. Our minds are out to kill us. The 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we practice these principles all of our affairs, you know. All of our affairs, our marriages, our relationships, our work. You know, I had to retire when I got here, when we moved here, and I don't like retirement all that much. I get to live with my husband every day. Every day. We're both excited. I want to tell you a story real quick. And I want to tell you this freaking miracle that happened to me last year. I went to this women's retreat. It was powerful. It was so powerful. A lot of the women sitting here were at that retreat. And we said the third step a lot. It was in June of last year. I surrendered something during that retreat, and I didn't know what. And when I got home, I realized that I had about a 30-year issue with my husband that I couldn't let go of. And so I started saying the third step prayer, and I kept on saying to God, hey, what's my bondage? What's this bondage of self? I mean, that's the third step right there. Because my little plans and little designs, let me tell you, they weren't working. And I said, I'm ready to see what are they. I hope you're sitting down for this. On our 52nd wedding anniversary, gasp, my husband planned a little weekend away for us with our dog, Charlie, who's adorable. And I would lay down because I was really tired. And I was laying in bed, and I said, God, I'm ready to be, this bondage to be removed. What is it that I can't see? I am standing here. I will not lie to you. I saw six of my character defects coming for me. They were rage. They were blame. There was, well, my first one is Pitiful Pearl. She's really pitiful. She has these wonderful pity parties, you know, and I just really know how to just put it on, just really feel sorry for myself. And I'd been saying for about 6 months to a year, oh, I'm sad. Oh, I'm so sad. I'm sad. And when I was laying in bed, I saw these six defects coming for me. And what I realized when I was asking God what the bondage of myself was, it wasn't just one thing. It wasn't one thing over the years. It was all these things combined that was blocking me from the sunlight of the Spirit. You don't stay married for 52 years to a jerk. You know, he's lovable. He's wonderful. He's kind. He's just not what I thought he would. He didn't ride in on a white horse. And like I said when I started off, when he went to Vietnam, he came back different, and by God, I was different. And who he was when he left, we were still kind of like on our honeymoon. Our first year anniversary, he was in Vietnam. If you ask God, or the God of your understanding, or your higher power, whatever it is, and if you're sincere from your heart and your soul, and you ask him, what is it that I can't see? I am standing up here and I am telling you, you will see it and you will be grateful. I don't drink because I don't want to go back to being that woman I was on October the 22nd. Oh, probably about 10 or 15 years after that, too. I was sober. But I think there's a difference between being sober and being recovered. And I think that this, we can get sober, but living a recovering life, I will never tell the women I sponsor that it's easy because it is not. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. I've quit smoking and I've quit drinking, and changing absolutely everything about me has been so hard because I want to hold on to it. But I just happen to have this God. And if you don't have one of your own, you can borrow mine. I'll tell you what, he's big. He likes going everywhere. He likes going to Hanford, I'm telling you. So there's one thing I want to end with, and it's Bill's story. And for the longest time, I thought I couldn't relate to Bill because I see I only have a story. I think I was the worst alcoholic at all because I was a housewife, you know, and I was home with my kids, and people trusted me with their kids in the car, and they trusted me. Everybody trusted me, and I'd become untrustworthy. But one of my sponsees and I are reading the big book again. And we stopped at this paragraph, and I wanted to read it to you because this is who I was before Alcoholics Anonymous, probably a time in Alcoholics Anonymous. No words can tell of the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morose of self-pity. I had met my match, I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. But God is my master now. Thank you for letting me share. Thank you.